There have been at St. John's generations of incredible leaders who have helped us to think about how we connect with the town of Huntington. And those folks, I'm thinking of folks like, like you all, and also folks who have gone from here, like Libby Hubbard, who was so deeply connected to the town, and others who have helped us to sort of remain fluent in what are the issues facing our region and our town by participating in various boards and community agencies, including, I think, on the Board of Family Service League.
Yes.
Some of those folks have aged and left us, and some of those connections that we've had with the town have loosened over time. And also our general knowledge, I think, of what's going on in the town of Huntington has also diminished in some ways because it's easy to lose track of what's really going on. And so Peggy Boyd, who works for Family Service League, which is our, I think it's the largest social service agency in Suffolk County, certainly, was gracious enough to join us today. This is not Peggy's first time here. Peggy was here for my installation and for some other notable services. I know that you're good friends with the Gilmores. And Peggy has been doing this work in our town for a long time. And so I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to invite Peggy to join us and have a conversation about the town, about what's going on in the town of Huntington and how the town has changed over the many years that Peggy has been working with Family Service League. So Peggy, welcome to St. John's. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
And So Peggy, welcome. Thank you for being here. Remind me, how long have you been working for Family Service
League?
Well,
I'm a lifelong Huntington resident, wonderfully, yes. And I get the pleasure of working and living in the same community. I've worked for Family Service League for about 24 years.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's a real treat.
Can you remind us, what does Family Service League do in our region?
So our primary focus and mission is to strengthen and enrich the lives of children, families, and communities throughout Long Island. We have programs from Mineola way out to the Fork. In total, I think we have nearly 60 programs in about 28 locations throughout Suffolk County, servicing the very young to the very old, the mentally ill to the chemically dependent. Big thrust of our work kind of goes into five areas: housing and homelessness, children and families, vocational services, mental health services, and senior services.
That's great. And 24 years is a long time to be doing this work. How did you get involved at the start? What drew you to the work?
So you learn what you don't want to do rather than what you want to do, I think, in life. And I'd gone to Marist College up in Poughkeepsie, and I had actually been working as an intern in probation. And I'll never forget, the probation supervisor said to me, I had this young boy in front of me, and there was a ton of reasons that he hadn't followed through with all the mandates that the court had asked him to do. None of those mattered, because the bottom line is he didn't follow through. And I remember going back and saying, well, he didn't follow through because his mom didn't have a car, and he didn't do this because, and it was always a family obstacle. And I remember being told, you need to violate him. So I realized I didn't really want to do the kind of enforcement and mandated kinds of things. I really wanted to make a difference and start to ask, well, how can I make that happen? So wonderfully, I came back to Huntington. I did the typical thing. I bartended and worked in all of our wonderful restaurants. And then I said, it's time to get a real job. And so I went to the town of Huntington Youth Bureau for a couple of years. I did I worked for something called Huntington Drug and Alcohol, which is an outpatient drug and alcohol service. I wonderfully learned, even though I'm one of nine and I grew up right on West Neck Road in Huntington, that there was a host of services that wonderfully no one in my family needed, but everything from runaway and homeless youth services to drug and alcohol services that the town spends about, I'm gonna say, $5 million on, you know, throughout the town, which is really an incredible, you know, tribute to the town, who has always recognized the importance of youth and children and families and community issues. From there, I transitioned to Family Service League. I got my master's at Stony Brook.
So you got your master's after you started working?
I absolutely did, yes.
Okay. So I know also from talking with you that you are a faithful person, that you go to church. So tell me about how does the work that you do at Family Service League connect with your life of faith, which is maybe not a question directly about the work of Family Service League, but hopefully will be of interest.
Being one of nine and a Catholic, an Irish Catholic, St. Patrick's is my home parish. And I went to St. Patrick's School growing up, and I went to Marist College. Faith has always been a pillar of what defines me and my family. I would love to go to Mass with my father because we'd end up at the Golden Dolphin, which we'd be told. We'd leave a little early and go over and have a bacon sandwich together. But my mother, she was a devout. You know, I used to drop her off. There was a time where I kind of strayed from services and I'd say, pray for me, and I'd drop her off at church. You know, I think there's different times in your life that you draw upon your faith, and obviously loss, happiness, all of those things have always called me back to my faith. Having gone to St. Pat's, I think I've always learned the values of there's always somebody else struggling, and there's always somebody else you can make a difference. I remember one of the nuns there down at St. Pat's saying that old statement that we all live by, I hope. I'm only one. I can't do everything, but I can do something. And I think that's the foundation of what the Catholic Church has given me. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the thing that you've done. Tell me about the poverty in Huntington. Tell me about, you've been doing this for 24 years.
I have.
I'm certain that a lot has changed in those 24 years. Can you tell us a little bit about how poverty has changed and the issues that face our town, how they have changed over those 24
sure.
years you've been working?
So little did I know, growing up in Huntington, and obviously my parents with nine kids must have struggled, but I had no idea what they were struggling with at different times. We always had food, we always had lights, we always had all those basic life necessities that I think any family would expect and want. It was predictable. What I found when I went to the Youth Bureau is, you know, I went on home visits and I was here working with the Youth Bureau and at times Family Service League, and we do these wonderful house tours and see the finest of homes, probably homes from you guys in many ways, homes down in Lloyd Harbor. And it wasn't what I was seeing in the station at all. What I was finding is children that were going home to maybe no parents, no lights, no kitchen table, no food. And so that was very early in my career. One of the changing moments in my career was actually a kid said to me, "Will you drive me home?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he said, "I live up on Jericho Turnpike," and he had a bike and I put it in the car. And I thought, I don't know of any homes on Jericho Turnpike. Well, he lived at the time at the Abbey Motor Lodge. And what I learned is he had lived there about 4 years at that point. He had been homeless, and back then, Suffolk County didn't have a shelter system for homeless families. And he described what I thought was horrific, basically living in plastic bags, being on bus rides for almost 3 hours back and forth, never having a friend over, never going to a party, and never participating in any after-school activities. Anthony, I have to say, life goes full circle. I met when I was getting my master's at Stony Brook. I lost touch with Anthony. I'm on Stony Brook campus, and here's this young man that came over to me. And at the time, it was this young man, Anthony, and he was going for his bachelor's. And I thought, wow, I can't believe that he's in this situation. Anthony had been raised in foster care homes after I had no longer worked with him. His mother had passed away way too young from a substance abuse issue. And somehow there were different people in his life that put things together. So Anthony was my first very rude awakening that something was not okay in many families. Subsequently, I went to go work at our public housing in Huntington, which is located behind Marshall's and Costco. And public housing, I didn't even know exists. It sounds like a very, very inner city term to me. And it was, It stands today. It's called Gateway Gardens, where it's subsidized housing for low-income families. And once again, I found myself troubled with the quality of life for many of those homes. But the difference today and what I see, what I saw back then is, when I interviewed families about their lives, it seemed it was generational poverty. It was predominantly African-American, low-income single moms. The difference that I see today is we have a demographic change that has steadily happened since 1997, where I believe now 53% of the kids that go to the Huntington School District are of Hispanic descent. We have a tremendous amount of change happening each and every day. This year alone, our family center, during the summer months, registered, I think it was like 14 kids in the school district that were considered to be the unaccompanied minors. So what I see is third world country poverty. These families are not entitled to many of the resources that we have that are governmental, public assistance or food, SNAP, it's called, you know, a supplemental nutrition, you know, program. So it's third world country poverty, where you have multiple families. There was a house fire. It was actually an apartment fire about in March. You guys were instrumental, and we connected at that point. But what should have been 21 apartments in East Northport, with 21 families, one would think, had nearly like 48 families there. It was terribly overcrowded. People were separated by sheets in each room. The rent was the same rent that any of us would pay, but in order to pay it, you had what I guess happened when people first arrived to this country. Lots of people living together to make that household work.
They're not, these families of Hispanic origin are not eligible for benefits?
Only if their children are born here. You know, the reality is if they're young, they typically are children that are our children, U.S. born children. But if you've traveled to the country illegally with your children, you're not entitled to the benefits of the, you know, state or the county.
So that's a significant difference between both populations, languages, and also the nature and the resources. What other issues? Children in poverty is enduring.
Right.
What else do we see in the town that's either enduring or new that is in your experience over these last 20 years?
So one of the greatest challenges this year, and it's shocking, is the number of suicides by children. This year alone, Family Service League, through our CCAT team, which is a crisis intervention, and we go out and meet with families after there's been a family death. There's been over 34 suicides this year that just our little agency alone has responded to. Of the 34, 26 have been young adults. So obviously mental health is a deep concern and people's ability to cope. Unfortunately, Huntington has been hit very hard by substance abuse, in particular the opioid epidemic, where it is foreign to me how we could have young people taking pills from their grandmother or their parents, good kids, really good middle class kids. This is a middle class problem. It was mostly people that I came to know, people I went to St. Pat's with, people that I went to Marist College with that were calling me and saying, I'm terrified. My niece, my nephew, my son seems to have an opioid addiction. And what happened was we tightened up the ability to get those drugs, and as a result, kids turned to heroin. So in the station, I still dealt with the crack and cocaine issue because that was a poverty drug. But in the village, what we were finding was, in not only the village, Lloyd Harbor, Cold Spring Harbor, a tremendous amount of young people seriously addicted to substances that take lives almost immediately.
Thank you for sharing that with us. There's been a group from St. John's who's been actively engaged, as you know, in those issues. Yeah. Tell us, I know that St. John's has been supporting for years several programs at FSL.
You have.
And I think, you know, our goal is to continue. How can we grow in our connection to Family Service League and to the issues facing our neighborhood and our town? In particular, when we spoke recently, you mentioned how much of poverty is unseen. How much of the suffering is unseen. How do we become more aware? How do we open our eyes to the suffering of those around us? And how can we be partners with FSL or others in alleviating the suffering and the pain that endures around poverty, around drug addiction, around substance abuse disorder? What can we do?
Well, I think there's always the public responsibility, which is, you know, I always think every child matters when I vote, and I want to know where people stand on issues, and we're entering an election. This is a key time to ask our elected officials, where do you stand on housing, children, regardless of, you know, their bloodlines? Where do you stand on those issues? Because those are what dictate funding to communities throughout New York State and in every state. So I think on a very high level, it's becoming, you know, involved in local politics, which is what oftentimes governs funding and opportunities. On a very immediate level, one of the things that I remember Laura saying to me when I reached out when there was this tragic fire was, people need to feel connected. And I was thinking, yeah, you know, people don't necessarily just want to write a check. They need to be on boards, they need to come and see or volunteer in a preschool or be willing to meet a family and maybe serve as a mentor. It may be having your kids come up and do homework help or tutoring. I think it's get involved in some way. Know that there's somebody else that isn't going home to a bed and a blanket tonight and saying, I can't fix it all, but what can I do? Can I go through my linen closets and get blankets? Can I go through my drawers and know that tonight, and one of our hidden secrets at Family Service League is, we sleep 60 homeless individuals every night. I don't say that proudly. I say it tongue in cheek because I promised the town I would not import homelessness to Huntington, and we've been doing it since 2005. The same year we started High High. But if you drove up and down Park Avenue, it wouldn't be foreign for you to see somebody really struggling. And I think oftentimes the response is, that shouldn't be happening in my town. Instead, if you pick up the phone and say, I was concerned I saw somebody struggling, what can I do? Rather than calling the elected official, that's a big beginning, is what can I do to make a difference?
Well, thank you for that. I think Laura and I have spoken with you before about finding ways to actually get our parishioners to do some of this volunteering, and I think we're working on that together, and I think we're looking forward to being a greater partner and ally with FSL, both through our kids and as adults. I think a lot of us think about community service and serving the community as something that teenagers do, but it's something that we all can do. It's something we probably all need to do to live out our lives of faith, as you said, doing one thing with great love rather than all things necessarily. So I want to invite questions as we've got Peggy here for a few more minutes, maybe a couple of questions that we might have from our congregation. And again, to say thank you. But are there any questions for Peggy about FSL, the work they do, or how poverty has changed in the town of Huntington over the last 24 years from her perspective? Peter.
Hi, Peter. Hi. I just wondered, I was... surprised, and I about what you said about suicides, about what you said about the homeless. I mean, not that I should be, but how is there a barrier to awareness? Is there something that seems to be like this is news that ought to be shared? People want to be aware of what's going on, and that might make a change. And I'd be, you know, very happy to work in any way with anybody on this particular subject. But is there? You mentioned something about the town maybe I misunderstood. The town somehow doesn't want it known that we have all this homeless history.
Well, think about it, Peter. Homelessness is a county responsibility. The county has the responsibility to house the homeless from the state.
Right.
The towns govern everything that relates to zoning, where housing is developed, affordable housing, all of those things. So the towns oftentimes will say, we don't want a shelter. We certainly don't want a low-income housing project. We certainly, and I think of Libby's work here, it's a challenge for the towns. And you know what? I live on West Neck Road. I'm real enough to say I don't want a shelter right next to my house. One of the things about 2 weeks ago I did, and I was horrified, was I went to, a man called me and he said, my father was an adult home operator his whole life. And when he said it, he said, and I inherited it by default. So now I'm in it 40 years. I don't see an exit plan for myself. Would Family Service League consider taking us over? So I drove out to Port Jefferson. I went to a home that had 49 individuals. Each person blended into the sheets, meaning they were so pale. They were laying in a bed. They were all 50 and above. A variety of mental health, substance abuse, medical issues happened there that I could tell. And every room had a flag. Every room had all sorts of veterans in it, I could see. So something like that wouldn't typically ever fly here. We would not put 49 individuals on a road, on a house on West Neck Road. Where do you put it? So I think it's always saying, how can we get our elected officials to say it is far too costly publicly in terms of taxpayer dollar to place them in a shelter or in, you know, a motel, and it's too costly in terms of human life. So I think it's insisting that our towns do the right thing and work to address this stuff. That home, I have to be honest, about 6 days later, I was bitten alive when I got there, and the bites didn't show up. It wasn't bed bugs, it was scabies. I couldn't believe the amount of pain I was in. I went to the doctor, I think, 4 times to get treated for this, and they were gone, you know, in a 2-week period, but I thought, oh my goodness, imagine all those seniors being exposed to this, mm-hmm. and no one doing anything. And in essence, this guy who owns that adult home, adult homes, you get $1,000 or $1,027 a month. So what do? You put a whole bunch of people in. The house is beautiful. It's a big old bed and breakfast. It's appropriate. It's adequate. But he hasn't invested in the home. And so I think, again, it's insistent that, yes, we can. Yes, we can find a way to allow for everyone to have some quality. And there's got to be an economy of scale. If you guys knew, I'll say it, $8 million. That's our contract to provide 100 families emergency housing on Crooked Hill Road. $8 million a year. That's what you guys pay as taxpayers. 100 families. Imagine if I could get each one of those families a year into an apartment. It's unconscionable. And why is that? Because no one wants housing development right next to their house. So we're not Queens, but we have a lot of land, and we need to be smart about how we use it. So the town needs to step up.
We used to do a lot of work, and before I got here, with Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah.
And I think it was more local than it is now. I think one of the reasons that we have stopped participating in Habitat for Humanity is that their projects have gotten farther and farther away from where we live. I mean, they're Wyandanch and South Shore, and so it's a lot less convenient for us to be involved in that work. Where is there housing on Long Island for people who are in poverty? Where can they find? Where can they go?
We tend to be able to rehouse families, and the state has done a little bit better. A family of four used to get about $700 a month if you were on public assistance.
For housing.
That was a state standard. It may work in Mudslide, New York, upstate somewhere, but you can't find a place to rent on Long Island in Suffolk County for $700 a month for a family of four. So there's been some movement, wonderfully, where the state standard is closer to the real market rent, but predominantly those rentals are out east. When we rehouse families at all of our shelters, one of our goals is obviously to rehouse, get permanent housing. And we have typically found them in the pockets of poverty in every community. There are pockets, Mastic, Quorum, you know, out in Riverhead. I think if people in Huntington Station were here, they'd say, not on us again. We don't want yet another low-income apartment or you know, housing development. So it always falls into lower-income areas, which is a challenge because they're quality of life issues as a result. When one of the things in Huntington, that last big project that went on was Millennium Hills. And basically, I think it was probably about 10 years ago it opened.
Near Melville?
Melville. Yeah. And it was half low income, half first-time home buyers. So there was renters and homeowners. Oh my gosh, behind the scenes, if I told you the conflicts that ensued and the racial conflicts on the little playground that they built, you're an owner, and my mother says, and because you can't dump people in the middle of nowhere. There was no bus, there was no like bus line at the time. The owners, it split almost predominantly along the racial lines, which was not good. Homeowners were white, first time home buyers, and the renters were predominantly African American single moms. The school district was very clear they didn't want this extra baggage. So it's a real challenge, but I think that we need to account for everyone. If for no other reason, but it makes no sense financially to put people in emergency housing. I mean, $8 million. Imagine what we right. could do in terms of permanent housing.
So most people call that a housing first model. Is that what you're
yeah.
advocating? What other questions are there? Yes.
Years ago, four or five of us from St. John's did some mentoring at middle school in Huntington Station on the road. I can't remember the name. And we had some courses where we were given advice as to how our instruction as to how to mentor. And that after about 2 or 3 years, it sort of fell apart. But I really enjoyed it. I mean, I had kids. It's great, I got to really like, and he got along beautifully, and one day he asked me if I could drive home, and I wasn't allowed to, but I went, asked permission and called his mother,
right.
and she said, yes, would you please bring him home? Turned out that his, well, I'm going to say this may not be accurate, but something like his older brother's girlfriend had been shot, no, I mean, it was his sister's boyfriend had been shot, kind of right out in front of their home, and he was afraid to walk home. And he was in walking distance of the school.
Right.
So I drove him home, and I could see his mother over in the shade and waved to me, and I knew he was there safely. But I wonder all of this, wondering if you have any kind of mentoring program or family service.
We do not, but we are going to be exploring some kind of mentorship at different times, different board members. Different friends of the agency have been the difference single-handedly in somebody's life dramatically changing. And so we've never made it a formal mentorship.
What we're looking into.
It is something that we're in active conversation about. We've got a meeting set up in a couple of weeks to begin exploring it. It has to be done in a structured environment, very thoughtfully, organized with the proper support so that people know correct ways of behaving in those kind of situations. And but we're really interested. We're interested in learning how many of our parishioners might want to engage in that kind of work. And Peggy is bringing a family that has done this kind of work, and it was life changing for both the family and for the young woman that they mentored. So
and this is young adult mentoring, not.
Right.
Not even children. But children. Kirsten, you still mentor, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yes. Oh, it was through Kirsten's
It was through the Mentoring Partnership of New York.
Do you want to say anything about how the Mentoring Partnership's going, or?
Well, the Mentoring, I have served on the board of the Mentoring Partnership of New York for quite a few years, and I don't get into the weeds on it, but they're really, they don't own the programs. Mentoring Partnership basically takes, like St. John's Church, who says we like to be involved in mentoring, and works with and helps you match what your interests and needs and time availability and so forth are with a school-based, it's always a site-based program.
Correct.
With supervision and training that goes in. And the there is a very, it's, you know, best practices, it follows best practices. And so we don't own, the Mentoring Partnership doesn't run the programs. They help train the supervisory and mentoring side, along with the mentee component for how to make those things work. It is a little bit challenging for a church to work in a school because of those separations. So it's, it sort of adds an extra step, but they're pros at helping to navigate it. But you do really. It's different than a Big Brother, Big Sister kind of program. It's very structured and site-based, and you are not replacing parenting. It's you are meeting them, and the requirement really is that you show up. It's that's the most important piece, is that you show up, and you usually don't know the background of the youth person that you're working with, because they don't know your background, right? So you're meeting on a level playing field, and the goal is to establish a relationship that's relational. So,
and there's wonderful instruction.
Jamie, you had a question?
We're exploring.
I just want to kind of make a statement, and I think this is appropriate about a way for us to help support Family Service League in Rotary. Is having its Taste of the Town event this Wednesday at Appliance World, and Family Service League has been something that Rotary has supported forever. And all, you know, a lot of other local charities that they support, and that's at Appliance World from 6:30 to 9 on Wednesday. If anybody's interested in coming, please talk to me afterwards. But that's an example of, you know, our, as a community, coming together and helping each other.
Thank you. You have a question?
I just wanted to say, I think we should probably
wrap
soon, but Peggy, could you just say, you know, like just a couple of words about the three programs that St. John supports, and help everyone in the room understand what they do and how our support helps?
Sure. For a very long time, Judy McAuley, along with many of you, one of my favorite people from this congregation, became involved in something called Hi-High. Started the Huntington Interfaith Homeless Initiative. Unfortunately, we started it with the idea that it would be a one-year thing. It is now, since 2005, every winter, starting December 1st and ending March 31st, we say no one freezes to death in Huntington. We're not making a statement about the undocumented. We're not making a statement about the county resources. What we do is we work with about 28 congregations, you being one of them, to make sure no one is left outdoors during the winter months in Huntington. We did it because right next to my family center, back in 2004, the year before we started it, I had found calming, meaning it was snowing, there was heavy tracks into the woods, and I found a town inside the town of Huntington. There was about 40 individuals, one of them being a mother with a three-month-old, living outdoors in the coldest of days. And they had no housing. They were not welcome to go through the county housing. And we didn't have any programs. So that year, I had a very unpleasant task. If it was 32 and above, I went and I took them away from a motel that we put them up in. Still bitter cold, still snow up to my knees. If it was 32 and below, we kept them in a motel, and we looked east, and oftentimes you don't need to reinvent the wheel. There was a great program. So Hi-High is something you sponsor and help with. with about 28 congregations. And basically, like I said, it's December 1st through March 31st, each and every night. We work really hard to make sure that anyone that is in need of housing is assisted if they won't or can't go through the county shelter system. Thank you, because you guys have been a financial contributor to that on top of the volunteer base working in partnership, I think, with Central Press and some other congregations, in particular on Monday nights. In addition to that, one of the unique things you've done, and to me, the only way to end poverty is education, and so preschool is an area you support. You have a wonderful summer program St. John's commits to, but you also commit to our preschool, which is kids 3 and 4 years old, that through an endowment at Family Service League, we have two people that have been incredible. They started an endowment, and you guys contribute to that. And in essence, what we're able to do is put kids that at par with other children in the school district. Most kids are in preschool, whether it's the Y to 10 others, before the age of 3. So this is an opportunity for us to get these kids in. It's never been just about the education. It's about the early detection of learning disabilities. I have to say that I had a child the other day I was really worried about in our preschool. And he came in with a lead paint note that he had a 15, the average should be a 4. He's chewing lead paint somewhere. And that's tragic. That potentially is extremely detrimental to his health. So it's never just about preschool. It's always about, can we help this family get their shots for their kids? Can we keep them in line with keeping, you know, it's easy when kids are young to be invested. Everyone comes to their graduation. They come dressed up and all. We keep saying to these parents and reinforcing, you need to be involved throughout your kid's entire education. You need to ask questions. You need to demand that the guidance counselor says what's going to happen after high school. I always like to reframe problems. I used to say to the town, we don't have a gang problem. We have a problem with education. After high school, lots of kids don't go on vocationally or educationally, so they sit on the corner and they become all of our issues. So that's two of the programs you support. And then wonderfully, we have a family center up at Huntington Station, and we offer homework help. And those kids come in, and the way they get fed is through free and reduced lunch at the school district, because even if you're undocumented, you're still eligible for the free and reduced lunch at the school district. So those kids come in, and I always believe it must be so humbling to drop your child off and let somebody else help them with homework. But that's what parents do. They stand at a door, and we have volunteers that help children do homework, and you guys provide the snacks so that those kids come in and can have something to eat after school. And oftentimes it's an incentive when you have very little to have something really wonderful. So I just want to leave you with one story that I think really makes us unique as an agency. Last May, every day I got a call from Town Hall and community residents, probably people like you in this room, that there was a woman, Jennifer, down in Huntington Village, out in front of Panera Bread, who was homeless. And she looked, she was white, she wasn't shaking anyone down, she was a really kind woman, but clearly mentally ill and homeless. And so Huntington, people would give her gift cards for food, and she wasn't moving on, but it was getting colder and colder. I met her in May, I called Adult Protection for Suffolk County. She didn't recognize she had a mental illness. She didn't know she was sick. She wasn't gonna go anywhere, and every night slept outside on that bench. She then moved to Cold Spring Harbor, and I got calls from the store owners down there. Then ended up back in Huntington, and in November, we decided, and I think it's who we are as an agency, and it's people like you that allow us to do this, but we said, if we put her into the shelter tonight, she was a U.S. citizen, she won't go. She'll leave. She won't fit in. She's so off that it won't work out. But we can't leave her out on the street, so let's put her in a motel. So to me, it's not every person's the same. You have a different plan for everyone. Little did I know we'd have our own motel for about 2.5 months, very costly, but we had the ability to do it as an agency. And Jennifer today, Jennifer is paranoid schizophrenic. She has something called Capgras syndrome, to make matters worse, which is you feel people are imposters. I know nothing about this stuff other than this is what she's been diagnosed with. Jennifer is a mom of a 19-year-old college student who she's not had custody of in many years. Jennifer was an accountant until she was 26 years old. Jennifer has some money set aside because she was an accountant that impacted her ability to get Social Security and different things. But fast forward to where Jennifer's at, and has been, it takes a village and you don't treat everyone the same. Jennifer is going for interviews for something called Single Point of Access, or housing for people with mental illness. Jennifer now gets an Invega shot, which helps her with her paranoid schizophrenia. She goes to a day treatment program. She sleeps at my building every night. And I've learned the most important lesson of my life. I used to say, why would anybody in her family leave her out on the street? She's clearly so sick. I met her dad. Her dad is almost 90. Her dad sat across the street every day at the library while she was out on those cold days. Couldn't force her to get help. He couldn't force systems to make her get help because she had the right to remain homeless. So I will never ask myself again, where is the family in this situation? Because I've come to know him, Tom, and he said, my hands were tied. I have a daughter who was mentally ill that refused to recognize she was mentally ill. I have a daughter I love dearly, but I can't take home because my wife is struggling with dementia. He's each and every day a part of her life, couldn't change her life. So I think that's who we are as an agency, is you hit a brick wall, you go to another door. She's doing okay, he's doing okay, and she's gonna be doing really well soon because she got Social Security disability also.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that story with us, and thank you for being with us.